was an aggressive and unfamiliar despair in his eyes. "They say we need to change, remove obstacles, and purge ourselves. Land reform brought equality, but 10 years later, it's already slipping away. It's obvious things aren't well in society."
"Purge ourselves of what?"
the professor asked.
"Individualism, privilege, the greed that is corrupting our revolution. The Politburo leaders haven't managed to become socialists,"
Sanli said.
"Why should we?"
There was a murmur of nervous laughter, which seemed to Sparrow to rise from the books themselves. Kai blushed and stood up.
"Comrade," he said to the old cat, "thank you for your hospitality. I can no longer listen to this conversation. Please excuse me."
The old cat and Ling had been talking to one another, and now paused, confused. The professor stared amazed.
"Kai, my boy, sit down, sit down. What's got into you? Sanli, didn't I tell you to hold your tongue?"
"I say what's on my mind."
Kai's voice was calm.
"You've never fought for anything, Sanli. You have no idea what life is like outside Shanghai, and yet you dare to lecture us."
"In the conservatory, you know better,"
Ling interrupted.
"Be quiet, Sanli.
Kai, sit down.
There's no need to take all this to heart. After all, we only come together to think differently, don't we? You're a brother to me. I know you're upset, but come..."
But Kai had already turned on the professor.
"You've already ruined me, and now you're endangering everyone in this room. For you, political struggle is just a game. It's taken me years to see you clearly."
The room was silent. The professor finally spoke.
"Since when did the desire to know oneself, to better oneself, become a traitorous act in this country? Should this not frighten you, Kai? My son, you forget that I, too, lost my entire family in the revolution."
Kai flushed. He swung his bag over his shoulder and walked out of the room.
"Sparrow," the professor said, "go with him. He's very disappointed. He doesn't mean what he says."
Sparrow didn't move.
"I'll take Julie home," Ling said. "You live near Beijing Road, don't you? So do I."
How calm Julie appeared, Sparrow thought, as if it were she who had brought him here. Had she? What had they done?
"Can't you hurry up?"
Ling said. There was a tremor of fear in her voice. Sparrow got up, wished everyone well, and left. The professor and Sanli exited together, mumbling apologies, and so it was only Zhu Li, the old cat, and Ling who remained. Nobody mentioned Kai, or what had happened. It was as if the argument had dissolved, having never been. "So the educated class is not so different after all," Zhu Li thought. "In these times, we all rely on silence." Ling told Zhu Li that she was a student at Jiao Tong University.
"In fact," she said, "I study utilitarianism, Mencius and the art of couplets, so I qualify as one of Sanli's slop-bucket philosophy students."
The old cat was reorganizing the books around her.
"Maybe you need a copy of this," she said, tossing a thin book to Zhu Li. "Foulet's translation of Jean Christophe. You know it, of course."
"I'm embarrassed to say that I haven't read it yet."
"I apologize."
The old cat lifted her soft shoulders and then, from this great height, let them fall like a landslide.
"I only suggest it because they say Roland modeled his Jean Christophe on Beethoven.
A Beethoven for the times we live in. However, not every page is exciting. There you go. And this, Hu Shi's essay on Wu Daozhi, a book outlawed, reviled by the government, and consequently very popular. When the old cat sat beside her, Zhu Li could smell crumbling paper, inkstone, and a whiff of sugarcane.
"Miss Zhu Li," Ling said, "do you carry your violin with you everywhere you go?"
The case in her lap was as cool as stone on an autumn night. Zhu Li nodded.
"A bit strange, don't you think?"
Ling said.
The old cat sniffed. "As strange as you carrying paper and pen in your pocket. You're a student, after all, and she's a violinist."
"Then Sun Li might as well carry a saber. It seems he majors in provocation."
"If you told him to stop carrying on, he might listen," the old cat said.
"Please, Sun Li would never perform for an audience of one."
Zhu Li wanted to ask them about Kai. Instead, she opened the Hu Shi essay and began to read the first lines. She flipped forward, read further. The text had been copied out by hand, in a square yet beautifully bold script. She turned more pages. This was the same hand that had copied the Book of Records. This was her own father's handwriting, and she would know it anywhere. The old cat peered at her.
"Quite a clever essay, isn't it?" she said.
Was it Zhu Li's imagination, or was there a question folded attentively inside this question?
"I'm sure it must be, but I find myself interested in the calligrapher."
To throw the old cat off the scent, she said,
"Did you make this copy yourself?"
"Ay," the old cat slapped her round knees with her round hands.
"It is an enviable gift, but not so divine as that. No, the calligrapher is a scholar from Shanghai. A poet, in fact. But alas, he is not a poet anymore. He fell under the wheels of the party, and they sent him for re-education. I haven't seen him for years. He disappeared. For a musician, you have a good eye for calligraphy."
"It's because my own handwriting is so poor," Zhu Li said.
"When my mother comes home," she thought, "the first thing I'll do is bring her here. That is the proper way to do things."
"On that note, I have something for you to decipher."
The old cat creaked herself upright, swayed past Ling, and stopped at a desk. Zhu Li had not even realized the desk was there, so camouflaged was it by papers. The old cat shuffled through a stack of folders before plucking out a single sheet. She handed it to Zhu Li.
"Well, grandmother,"
Zhu Li said, after a moment. In her hand was the aria of the Goldberg Variations, transcribed into the numbers, dots, and lines of Jianpu notation.
"You've gone and dropped a bag of books on me. I had no idea you studied Western classical music."
"I don't. Someone left this at my door. When, a month ago?"
She looked to Ling, who nodded in confirmation.
"Sure, I can read Jianpu, but I have no clue what this music is."
Zhu Li told her it was Bach.
"Oh, him."
The old cat sounded disappointed.
"I was hoping it might be that handsome firecracker, Old Bay. My niece and I have been inserting this piece of music into traditional songbooks."
Ling smiled mischievously. "Aunt and niece," Zhu Li thought. "So this is why I felt so comfortable with them."
"We throw it in at random, just to cause a little frisson. I added the words of Chairman Mao as a libretto. On a blank sheet of paper, free from any mark, the freshest and most beautiful pictures can be painted.
But who is the mysterious sender?
Julie asked. Who knows? There was a note which said that even banned music should be assessed on its own merits, that songs as well as novels could serve as samizdat, passed from person to person. Some foolish idealist. One of your kind, I'm sure.
Someone from the conservatory?
Julie said.
At first we thought it was the professor or a Kai, Ling said. But they both swore it wasn't them. In fact, Kai told us turn it in to the authorities. I swear the boy is afraid of his own feet. But isn't Kai right to be cautious? Julie asked.
She thought Ling and her aunt were perversely unaware, as if they had never attended a political study session or encountered a blackboard newspaper.
I know what you're thinking, the old cat said. But child, when you've seen as much as I have, you realize the die is cast. The so-called enemies of the people are the ones whose luck has run out. Nothing more. One day, the traitor is Shen Chongwen. The next, Guo Moruo. If they want to come for you, they will come.
And it doesn't matter what you read or what you failed to read.
The books on your shelves, the music you cherish, the past lives you've lived, all these details are just an excuse. In the old days, spite and jealousy drove the eunuchs in all their power struggles. Perhaps we live in a new age, but people don't change overnight.
But why give the authorities an excuse? Julie asked. If the neighborhood can turn in one family of counter-revolutionaries, the whole block might be saved. People are just trying to get by.
A voice in her head scolded her. Why do you persist in playing music that is outrageously formalist? Why did you react disdainfully when Kai brought you the correct music? Are you too idiotic to realize that the very existence of a violin soloist is counter to the times?
Because, Julie, the old cat said, these books were bequeathed to me by my beloved father. At some point, a person must decide whether they belong to the people who loved them, or whether they belong to the emperors. The truth is, my ancestry is long, and my past is complex, because this country is old. Ah, our country is old. How can the party convince me otherwise? I know who I am, and I know what old means. If the party knows it too, well, good for them. I must meet the destiny that was written out by my lineage. If they want to hurry me into the next life, okay. I'm old. I'll go. I would only miss my little Ling. The things you experience, she continued, are written on your cells as memories and patterns, which are reprinted again to the next generation. And even if you never lift a shovel or plant a cabbage, every day of your life something is written upon you. And when you die, the entirety of that written record returns to the earth. All we have on this earth, all we are, is a record. Maybe the only things that persist are not the evildoers and demons, though admittedly they do have a certain longevity, but copies of things. The original has long since passed away from this universe, but on and on we copy. I have devoted my minuscule life to the act of copying.
Don't listen to her, Ling said. When the authorities come, She's soft as porridge. She knows how to ply them with old woman words.
The old cat grunted.
Sure, that too.
Still, Zhu Li said, in these times, we should take precautions.
Ah, child, sometimes an old woman simply gets set in her ways. She's like a pain you can't dislodge.
Ling, San Li, Kai, the old cat, they must all come from exemplary class backgrounds, Zhu Li realized. They had never been targeted, and so, deep in their bones, did not believe they could be. They were free because in their minds, they persisted in believing they were. Maybe they were right, but Zhu Li felt as if she were watching an oil drum that was about to explode. She began to shift the books off her lap so that she could get to her feet. Still seated, Ling reached out to gather the empty cups. The old cat was humming to herself, and the resemblance between the old cat and Ling made Zhu Li feel as if she were standing between two arias. Maybe these volumes of books acted as a kind of sponge, shielding the old cat from the muck of the city outside her door. The violin case knocked against Zhu Li's knee. She was glad they had not asked her to play for them. Each time she lifted her bow to perform, she felt as if parts of her were being peeled away.
"It was fate that you found us," the old cat said. "Or, to put it another way, fate that I found you again."
"What do you mean?" Zhu Li asked. She was holding her father's book in her hands.
"Oh,"
the old cat said. The smile on her lips tried to hide a lasting pain.
"Ignore my rambling. My thoughts wander from time to time. I get lost in the things that were."
Sparrow pedaled his bicycle behind Kai. There was no moon, only haphazard lighting, a low wattage bulb in a window, the glow from the oil lamp in an outdoor kitchen. At last, the pianist coasted to a stop.
"Forgive me, Sparrow," he said, turning. He was shivering as if he were ill. "I had to do it. I had to draw a clear line. Please let me go. I have to. There's no choice, can you understand? I have to do it for my parents, my sisters. I'm the only one left. I'm sorry. I'm truly sorry."
They were sheltered by a willow so heavy with leaves, its branches swept the ground. Kai looked at him with a beseeching air.
"Let me go. There's nothing else to do. We must trust the party in everything. Everything."
He turned and began pedaling away. After a moment, Sparrow, too, began pedaling again, but slower now. Other travelers drifted between them, and up ahead, Kai merged into the darkness and slowly disappeared. Sparrow rode for what seemed a long time, but the boulevard continued, endless. The wind picked up, and he heard a hollow banging on the air. Everyone began pedaling faster, hoping to get home before the downpour, but it was already too late. Lightning broke the sky apart. Rain smacked the concrete so hard it ricocheted up, hard as pellets. He was instantly drenched. In a single moment, the rain had swept everyone off the road, towards shelter, and only a single car pushed on, oblivious. Sparrow turned into a laneway and dismounted. All he could think about was his desire to be with Kai, to pass another night with him. The desire was sharp and undeniable. "I care for him, yes. And what difference does it make, how, and to what degree? To whom does it matter?" He stood gripping the handlebars, bewildered by his own self-delusion. To love as he did was, if not a counter-revolutionary crime, foolhardy and dangerous. Such love could only lead to ruin. Behind him voices called out, but the words were only gusts of air. A child reached out and firmly pulled him sideways under the shelter of a tree. All Sparrow saw was the sudden disappearance of a city full of people. At last, the rain ebbed. The road was silver with water. People came into the road anyway, their legs disappearing, sometimes up to their knees. He climbed back onto his bicycle. Almost immediately, he sank down as the front tire gave out. He must have hit a nail or a shard of glass. Sparrow was aware, suddenly, of the cold weight of his wet clothes and the water that dripped down from his hair, down his neck and back. He began pushing the bicycle beside him. Already, the clean rainwater smelled of mud. He saw a dead chicken floating toward him beside a head of cabbage. An eddy came, sucked the chicken down, and pushed it back up again. A little girl came running towards it, her long hair pasted alarmingly to her face. As he walked, the water slowly drained away. Sparrow saw the cuffs of his trousers, then his ankles and his shoes. He had the numbing fear that the Shanghai that existed only moments ago was gone. It had been washed away and replaced. Sparrow kept pushing his bicycle. Up ahead, at the intersection, people had gathered around a haze of lights. Sparrow barely noticed them. The air was humid once more. A musical idea had appeared in his thoughts, a wedge of notes. He must hurry home to write the phrases down. Chords opened. They made a bright uneasiness in his ears. He was suddenly engulfed by the crowd at the intersection and tried, stubbornly, to hear only the unfolding music. People became a series of figurations, girls wearing red scarves, a taunting voice, dissonant bursts of light. The very loudness of the crowd seemed to make it silent. Was it rage, he slowly realized, that was spilling back and forth from one cluster of people to another? There was a fire, Sparrow now realized, his vision sharpening. He tried to pass through the mass, but his bicycle made it impossible. In the center, an old man was standing on a chair, the crowd swaying around him, pressing closer. Sparrow saw a young woman, Zhu Li's age, holding a broom by its handle, waving it before the old man. Sparrow thought the man on the chair would take the handle and begin a speech to the crowd, but then he realized the old man, soaked from the rain, was shaking with cold. He was weeping and trying to avert his eyes from the young woman and her taunting gestures. "Down with Wu Bei!" The ferocity of the chanting finally broke through Sparrow's thoughts. The old man was begging for mercy, but none of his words were audible. For a fleeting moment, Sparrow thought he should step forward and push these children back. Some of them were no more than 9 or 10 years old, but there were many bystanders, people of all ages, pressing in with a growing euphoria. He tried to go backwards, but it was impossible. The crowd was surging forward once more. Scattered words were flung up. Reactionary, counter-revolutionary, traitor, demon, until the chant started up again. Down with Wu Bei! The girl with a broom handle was accusing him of teaching literary works that mocked the reality of every man and woman standing before him.
"You thought you could trample those beneath you," she said. She had a disconcertingly melodic voice. "You thought your high standing should make us small, but we are the ones with open hearts and clear minds. The monster is waking, teacher. You have stepped on its head countless times, but now the monster is crawling out of the mud. It is ugly and unmannered, free from your disdain and superiority. Yes, the monster is the seed of truth that you try to lock away. We are free, even though you try to warp our minds, even though you corrupted our desires. She began to beat him, slow hits, with the length of the broom, against his back, his thighs, and chest, as if he were an animal she was punishing. The old man tottered and fell. He was picked up and forced roughly back on the chair, even though he could barely stand. "Fall down, and we will only slap you harder," the young woman said sweetly. "What a small punishment this is for your crimes. But don't fear. Every weakness will be attended to. This is only the beginning." Someone came and pulled up another chair, and a boy pushed a long, white, pointed paper hat onto the old man's head. The crowd erupted in derisive laughter, pointing and shouting. The old man had turned so pale, it looked as if he would pass out. Scrawled on the dunce cap were the words, "I am an enemy of the people, a spreader of lies. I am a demon." Arms were lifted. The feverish chanting began again, drowning out the young woman who was still speaking. Sparrow could not move. Each chant seemed to hit the man's body like a physical blow. Another person came and affixed a long sheet of paper to the man's chest. The words read, "I teach shit. I eat shit. I am shit." Howls of laughter rang out, and the young man who had affixed the poster was overcome by hilarity. "Hubei," he cried. "We can smell your shit across Shanghai, you silly boy. Why don't you clean yourself up?" The old man who once had stood before a lectern and tried to unravel the codes of literature, just as he, Sparrow, tried to understand the shape of music, wept in fear and humiliation. He would suffer less, Sparrow thought, if they tied him up and beat him unconscious. But the crowd only continued to taunt him. "I am an enemy of the people," he was saying now. They forced him to repeat line after line. "I have corrupted the thoughts of the students entrusted to me. I have fed foreign shit into their bright and beautiful minds. I am a traitor to my country. I deserve death." And then his own whimpering. "Have mercy. Have mercy." A gap opened up beside Sparrow, and he slipped through it, the knot of the crowd quickly closing behind him. Gap by gap, he pushed his way forward. "In a hurry?" someone asked him. He was shoved, but did not shove back. "What's your name and work unit?" the same voice asked.
"I'm only trying to get closer," Sparrow said, terrified.
The person laughed, disbelieving.
"Look at the monster! The monster!"
Someone else said, "Soon we shall be at every window inside every home." The fire had grown, and the laughter grew louder and louder. The man's personal papers were being displayed like trophies of war. Someone was reading the titles of books, and each one was greeted with guffaws and insults. Words were hurled at him. Bourgeois, capitalist, imperialist, wolf, and the young woman continued her rhythmic alternation between hitting him viciously and berating him. When it seemed as if she might tire, a young man took her place, and the chants escalated again.
"There are no kings," the young man said. "No aristocrats, no landowners, no teachers, no natural ruling class. There are only locusts like you. Thieves and pestilence."
"Set him on fire," the crowd begged. "Feed poison to the snake."
They threw ever more books and papers onto the fire, and even furniture and clothing. A child's silk dress was found and paraded through the crowd. The young woman came back with a large bottle of ink. She climbed up onto the chair beside the old man, pulled off the paper hat, and emptied the bottle onto his hair. The man tried to pull away, but the ink poured into his eyes, ran down his nose and mouth, and slid in hideous shapes down his body.
As the old man tried desperately to wipe the thick liquid from his eyes and mouth, the crowd screamed a hysterical laughter.
"Write something," they shouted.
"Wu Bei, enlighten us with your sophisticated thoughts. Compose a profound essay."
"Please, we beg you, tell us what to think," the young woman said.
"Wu Bei, you've made a mess again."
"Stupid, dirty child," the young man said, raising the stick menacingly.
The old man cowered and wept.
"Don't move, don't move," the young woman said. "You're ruining my elegant calligraphy."
Sparrow moved backwards, step by tiny step, the metal frame of the front wheels scratching against the ground. Wu Bei's humiliation was a game that kept intensifying. Each person wanted to think up the next salvo. The crowd was giddy. Even the moon above and the ragged summer trees seemed to shudder with elation. Wu Bei was completely alone, balanced clownishly on his wooden chair. Another young man had stepped forward, with a razor in his hand, and was proposing that he shave the old man's head.
"He thinks his white hair makes him respectable," the young man said. "Shall we clip the butterfly's wings?"
"Melt the autumn frost," another voice shouted. "Rip off his wings! Cut off his hair!"
A wave of nausea overcame Sparrow. There was no more oxygen to breathe.
"Why stop at his hair?" the man with the dull razor said. "Why should we allow His Excellency to belittle us?"
Sparrow forced himself to turn casually away from the crowd, bending forward as if to check the bicycle's tire. He glanced towards the edge of the road, where a dozen plane trees stood aligned. There, under the nearest one, he saw Zhu Li, standing by herself, lost in thought. She stood out because she was the only motionless person in this crowd. Zhu Li held her violin tightly in her arms and was listening to the chanting as if to an excessively complicated piece of music. They had taken the razor to Wu Bei.
"Can't you even find a decent barber, Wu Bei?"
"You're ready for the dance now. Put on your three-piece suit and wait for the orchestra."
"Come and waltz with me, Wu Bei. Don't be shy."
Broken, the old man let out a howl of grief, and the crowd erupted in jeering victory. Sparrow walked calmly towards his cousin. Wu Bei slipped from his mind. Zhu Li should not be here with her violin. He must get her home. He walked towards her, lengthening his gait to appear confident and tall. "Cousin," he said when he reached her. She turned and looked at him with keen eyes. For a moment, he faltered, and then he repeated more sternly, "Cousin." She hardly seemed to breathe. He began walking Zhu Li away, his bicycle beside them. More people were coming to join the frenzy. They carried bottles of ink and rolls of paper, and they wore red armbands that, in the dim light, glowed against their arms.
"No,"
Zhu Li said, turning back towards the noise.
"Not this way. I'm going to the conservatory."
"Ling was supposed to see you home," he said. He had to fight to keep his voice calm. "I never would have left you otherwise."
"She did take me home, but I came out again after the rain. I reserved the practice room, you see," she said. "I must go. Room 103. It's the best room, you know, because the piano is very old. Nobody plays it. But I told you that once, didn't I? And I have my concert coming so soon. It's less than 3 months away. I don't know what's wrong with me. I can't seem to memorize the Ravel."
"Come, Zhu Li," he said. "Let's go home together. I'll help you, I promise." She was looking at him now. She sighed and followed behind him.
"Where are we going, cousin?"
He did not answer. After a moment, she said again,
"But where are we going?"
"Home. Give me your violin." she would not. They walked in the shadows. Red guards, careening recklessly along the path, barely noticed them. When one or two stared, Sparrow called out to them.
"They're bringing down that traitor, Wupei. The coward has already pissed himself."
The red guards collapsed in laughter. They shouted, "Long live the revolution!" and hurried on, afraid they had missed the show. Behind them, the crowd had reached the crescendo of a poem by Chairman Mao, their voices ringing. "We wash away insects and are strong." Sparrow and Zhu Li arrived home, in the laneway. His brothers were in bed, but Ba Lut was sitting at the window in the darkness. He started when they entered.
"Ba," Sparrow said.
"Door by door,"
Ba Lut said softly.
"They're going to every house."
Zhu Li had moved halfway into the cold room.
"But, Uncle, you're a party member."
Sparrow almost said, "So is Wupei." But when he saw his father's face, he said nothing.
"If it comes to unending revolution," Ba Lut said, "even party members and heroes must take their turn."
He smiled and seemed to laugh, and Sparrow felt a trickle of fear running down his spine.
"Father, why don't you go to bed? I'll stay awake."
"In bed, or here, or in the road, I won't be able to sleep."
"You must," Sparrow said firmly.
"Where is your mother?"
Ba Lut said in despair.
"Off, endangering herself and all of us, pretending she can rescue poor Wun? Who does she think she is? Does she have the ear of our great leader? Is she so invulnerable?"
"I'm sure she's written to us. Only the post has been so chaotic these past few weeks."
"No. No,"
Ba Lut said, speaking to himself.
"It was not supposed to be like this. I criticized all the others at headquarters. Give up your feudal allegiances, I told them. Give up everything for the party. Lenient treatment for those who confess, severe punishment for those who refuse. But a reward, yes, a reward, for those willing to surrender others. They believed me, and I believed myself. It's so much easier to believe than to disbelieve."
"Father," Sparrow said, but Ba Lut wasn't listening to him.
"After all, what good can come from disbelief? What grows? What changes? What improves? Isn't it always better for your country, your family, for yourself, to believe in something? Doubt can only lead to confusion and complications. And in my case, our lives were better. We didn't mean to grow complacent. Surely we weren't complacent. The struggle isn't finished, and yet..."
Ba Lut got up. His great hulk seemed absurdly small. He walked slowly from the room, shaking his head and saying,
"In everything, I trust the party. I trust Chairman Mao. But no, no, I never wanted this."
After Ba Lut had left the room, Sparrow sat with Zhu Li in uneasy quiet. The curtains were closed, but they could hear the vibration in the streets, waves of chanting and jubilation.
"This campaign is beginning very fiercely," Zhu Li said.
She said it lightly, as if she were discussing a new piece of music.
"Actually, someone denounced you, Sparrow. I saw it myself."
"The entire faculty was denounced. They can't shoot us all."
When she didn't answer, he joked that he would welcome the change. Time in the desert
away from his ambitious students, would be a reprieve. Finally, some time to focus on his own work. Julie wasn't listening.
"I've hardly seen you in the last few days. Where have you been? What have you been doing?"
"Thinking."
"Have you finished the new symphony?"
"Ah," Sparrow said, "it's barely a symphony." Julie smiled, but her face in the darkness looked very pale and thin. In another couple of months, she would turn 15, but she didn't look it. She appeared frail, as if her childhood sturdiness had abandoned her and left her with nothing to replace it.
"If you're looking for compliments, I won't oblige. I know how much you hate them. But, Sparrow, this symphony of yours, it helps me remember what music is. This symphony is the most honest thing you've ever written, and it makes me afraid for you."
"Cousin, you must be exhausted. Why don't you rest?"
She smiled. "I'm not exhausted. In fact, I feel as if all my life I've been sleeping, but now, finally, I'm coming awake."
"In what way have you been asleep?"
"I see now," she said, "that all the hours of practicing, all the commitment, the ambition, and the fantasizing, it's all coming to a climax."
She was silent for a moment.
"I'm moving too slowly. What was it that Professor Tan taught me about Sigan? The one who plays too slowly will be swallowed by time."
"Nonsense."
"Yesterday," she continued, "when I left the conservatory, I walked into the courtyard, and out of nowhere I was surrounded by my classmates. They said that I must now come down to their level. They tried to grab my violin. I kept saying, 'I'm a patriot. I want to serve my country.' But they just laughed and said, 'The butterfly belongs to no country. The rightest bitch needs a lesson.'"
She paused, folding her hands together with an earnestness that seemed to take over her entire body.
"A few others came running from inside, and there was an argument. It turned into a fight, but Tofu Liu and I managed to get away. If Tofu hadn't been there, I might have been in real trouble."
She was laughing.
"We ran away, and I thought how strange it is that I am the one running, because they are the ones afraid of a world they can't control. Last night they went to Tofu Liu's house. You know him, don't you? So gentle he can hardly turn a page. They went through his house, beat his parents, smashed the furniture, all the musical instruments. His father is a rightist, accused in 1958, the same year as my father."
"Why did you agree to go to the study group?" Sparrow heard the change in his voice, as if he was accusing her, and was appalled by himself. "Why didn't you tell me?"
"Because when Kai came this morning, I saw that you were happy. I was glad to see you joyful. And Kai is our friend, isn't he?"
"Because I know, of course I see things, too. I think there is nothing to say."
"You are not to practice in the conservatory. I'm sure everything will return to normal, but you mustn't do anything to attract their attention."
"Do?"
she said.
"What should I do? Sparrow, do you know that Kai is a Red Guard now? I heard. He led the attack on Tofu Liu's parents."
"You imagined it." She stared at him, stunned.
"How could I imagine something like that?"
"Kai was with me last night," Sparrow said.
"Was he with you all evening?"
He lied to her. He did it without thinking. "Yes." She shook her head.
"Tofu Liu saw him, and Kai was there at the conservatory when my classmates surrounded me."
"No, it's impossible."
Well, she said. Disappointment surfaced in her eyes and then was pushed away. If it's impossible, then I must be mistaken.
Did Sparrow believe that she would make things up? Had she ever done such a thing before? Julie's thoughts twisted uselessly. Yesterday afternoon, her classmates had stared at her with contempt, as if she were a traitor. The change had seemed to happen in a moment. Or maybe, she thought, the feeling had been inside them all along, but she had not understood it until she saw it in Kai's expression. Beside her, Sparrow said nothing. The children of class enemies are the enemies of the people. This daughter of a rightist is a dirty whore. 2 months ago, she knew she might have been swayed to denounce her own mother. She might have done anything to protect her place at the conservatory. If they took music away from her, she would die. Yes, that was how perfidious the children of class enemies were. Her parents, meanwhile, the convicted traitors, had never implicated or denounced anyone. What did it mean? The people should come first, above family and self, above petty concerns like attachment and music and love. No more Prokofiev, no more Ravel, no more of the world instilled in her by Bach, no more Western music meant to be passively received. What were the words that Prokofiev had set to music? Believe, comrades, and it will come to pass. We must struggle, Chairman Mao had said. We are heirs to a better world. Equality will protect us. Equality will make us powerful. She broke the silence.
I'm not well, Sparrow. Something is wrong in my head. I must have imagined everything.
Dear Julie, go and rest. I'll wake you if something happens.
Dear, she thought. How brave he was to use such nostalgic language. If she truly wanted to protect her family, shouldn't she turn herself in? But for what crime? Her thoughts frightened her. They made no sense. The shouting had decreased in volume. The students had turned towards another street. These are professors' lodgings, Julie said. Even if they don't come here tonight, we're like eggs in a nest.
Sparrow could not help but notice how Julie clutched her violin. He had an image of Wynne the Dreamer holding the battered suitcase, names sliding out like bits of clothing. He tried to clear his thoughts. Julie was only a child, and children would not be harmed. Children, the chairman said, carried the seeds of revolution. In the pre-dawn darkness, Julie went to the conservatory to return the score of Beethoven's Emperor. The library was locked, and she found herself inside room 103, a room she had never entered before without her violin. There was no one around. She closed the door, sat down on the floor, and rested for a long time. She had a desire to stop time moving so quickly. Julie had stayed awake rereading Chairman Mao's talk on art and literature. But each time she felt a truth might be appearing, it muddied and broke away. The chairman's words were elegant, perfectly sharp, but when they touched her thoughts, they became crooked. Unable to sleep, she had written a long self-criticism, but it was not the kind that the party demanded. Instead, the same reactionary words kept rising to the surface and dirtying the page.
Who am I at the base of things? Do I have the ability to change?
Say all you know, the chairman had written, and say it without reserve.
But there is more and more that I question. I'm afraid to hear what I think. I know that the party is right in all things. I say it is right, but even the simplest truths don't seem like truths at all.
We can learn what we did not know. We are not only good at destroying the old world, we are also good at building the new.
What if the new is nothing but a virus of the same sickness? And what about devotion? What about duty and filial love? Must everything that is old be contemptible? Weren't we also something before?
Why are you defending a musical culture that is not your own? She pinched her hands, and the pain shot all the way to her neck.
Enough of these thoughts. They're all useless because at the base, somewhere, I know what the party says is right. Only, I'm so selfish. So selfish.
She heard scuffling nearby. Julie stood. A low moaning was coming from the cellars in the basement. Had someone been down there this entire time? Her body began to tremble. No, she told herself. Her mind was troubled. She'd hardly slept. Still, she heard someone moaning in pain. Room 103 struck her, for the first time, as an echo of the underground library. Julie left the room, rushed up the stairs and out into the warm air. It was still early, still dark outside, as if the counting of time had paused and was only now being restarted again. She had the family's oil and grain coupons in her pocket, and she walked in a daze, her hand over the opening, hiding them and protecting them. Since Big Mother and Swirl's departure, it had been her responsibility to pick up the rations. The queue for oil had already reached Ji Lu Road. When she saw how long the line would take, her distraction turned into guilt. She should have come here first thing. It had been a mistake to go to the conservatory. She had known better, and yet, once again, she had followed stupidity and selfishness. She took her place at the end of the line, behind a girl who wore nothing on her feet and whose eyes were squeezed shut. The cut of her hair was as blunt as an anvil. Nobody spoke. Every building was shrouded in red banners. A broken chair lay in the road beside a length of rope caked in what looked like ink. Three phrases swung together in her thoughts. Party-mindedness, people-mindedness, ideological content. It is my thinking, Julie thought. Everything correct becomes something poisoned. If only I could quiet my thoughts. She felt as if she hadn't closed her eyes in days. Distribution wouldn't begin for another hour. Perhaps, if she was lucky, she would reach the front of the line by noon. If they ran out of oil, she would come again the next day. She would give in. She would forget the conservatory and walk away. A weight lifted from her shoulders at this thought.
Yes, she said, startling the girl beside her. She was addressing these thoughts to Kai, but the thoughts no longer seemed like hers. There is always tomorrow, and the day after, and the day after. It's not too late to reform and grow. Around her, people, buildings, objects, all appeared disproportionately large. Not only their substance, but their shadows, too. Had there ever been such a light-filled July? She saw now that she was standing beside a wall covered in posters. Denounce the, destroy the, rise up and, eradicate shame. The words written in colossal characters of red ink buzzed in her thoughts. Bombard the headquarters. It sounded like a game that Flying Bear and Da Shan had invented. How odd it must feel to write violent words in such orderly calligraphy. Julie shook the thought away. Dissonance required as precise a technique as beauty. In her mind, Prokofiev's libretto kept repeating, "The philosophers have tried in different ways to explain the world. The point is to change it." Prokofiev quoted Marx, The Red Guards quoted Chairman Mao. Everyone shouted borrowed ideas. Her classmates memorized the chairman's slogans and adopted his poetry as their own. So we are not so different from one another after all, Zhu Li thought. Except that I speak in the language of Bach and the musical ideas of Prokofiev. But still, none of us knows the true nature of our voices. No matter the cause, none of us speaks with our own words. At the core, is there only desire but no justice? All we've learned since the fall of the old dynasties is how to amplify the noise. This noise was splitting inside her now. She heard Sparrow's Symphony No. 3, as if from the air itself. Her own voice wept. There is always tomorrow, and the day after. It must not be too late. The line nudged forward. Zhu Li had nearly reached the head of the line. Each time she saw another person leaving, their full quota of rations in their exultant hands, she felt increasingly giddy. She allowed herself to count the people in front of her. 18. It was midday. The shade had long retreated, and in the glare, the buildings were dissolving into watery reflections. She stepped to the side and peered ahead. 17. The pavement had dulled to grainy whiteness. There was a growing disturbance behind, but Zhu Li focused only on obtaining the rations, didn't turn. Voices chafed, followed by a woman's fearful answer, a sagging E minor tone. She was easily drowned out by taunts. Still, Zhu Li wouldn't turn. Ahead of her, the queue had begun to shift, and in her exhausted thoughts, she saw the line as if from above, a millipede straining its tiny head forward. Zhu Li was up against the barefoot girl in front of her, and when the girl turned, Zhu Li turned as well, as if they were joined. She saw a woman being pulled from the lineup. The woman was her mother's age. A Red Guard, a tall, spindly girl, was pushing down on the back of the woman's neck, as if the woman were an ox. The woman was wearing a pale blouse and a navy skirt that fell below her knees. It must be her clothing, Zhu Li thought dully, that had attracted the fury of the Red Guards.
"Comrades, look at this trash!"
the tall girl shouted, dragging the woman along the line. The girl was yelling so loudly, her pink mouth seemed to swallow her face. Zhu Li fought the urge to giggle, to dissolve in skittishness, to turn away and hide her shock. But just at that moment, the girl pushed the woman straight towards her.
"Slap her insolent face!"
the girl screamed. Zhu Li froze.
"Slap her!"
the girl shouted. Someone next to Zhu Li reached out and gave the woman a stinging slap. The sound, or was it the echo, was soft and drawn out. The woman's face was hidden by her dark hair, which had come loose from its elastic. And then her head was yanked back, and Zhu Li saw blood on the woman's mouth, both full and delicate. The woman, she thought dully, was being punished because of the desire, the degeneracy, inside her.
"You, comrade!" the girl cried.
Zhu Li lifted her eyes.
"Teach this whore a lesson!"
Someone very near, a man, was speaking in her ear.
"Go ahead. Don't be afraid. We all have lessons to learn. Don't hesitate."
The woman was so close to Zhu Li, she could see the trembling of her eyelids and new droplets of blood starting to form. The girl was screaming words that made no sense. "Where have I put the ration coupons?" Zhu Li thought, perplexed. "Has the line moved? I don't want to lose my place. I've been waiting such a very, very long time." She lifted her right hand, but nothing happened.
"Go on,"
the man urged, softly, so softly.
"What's wrong?" Don't hesitate.
More and more people pressed towards them. The woman was suddenly yanked away. Julie's hand remained open,